afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Laurie Institute again. I think now I see a couple of faces from people who were here last night for our event on the latest political turmoil and its implications for foreign policy. So it's great to have you back again. Thank you very much. Today we're talking about a completely different topic, and we're squarely in our patch about what exactly is the United States doing in our region? How do we interpret these latest and some perhaps inconsistent moves by what is the preeminent power globally, but also historically in the region? And with me today to talk about this, I can't think of a better panel or a more qualified panel to discuss this pretty important topic. At my far left, we have Richard McGregor, who is a senior fellow at the Institute. He is a former bureau chief with the Financial Times in Shanghai, Beijing and Washington, and for the Australian in Tokyo and Hong Kong. He wrote what I think is the definitive book on the Chinese Communist Party, called The Party, and he's actually launching tonight in paperback his next book, Asia's Reckoning, at Glee Books with Peter Harter, which will be a very interesting event. His book looks at what the fault lines are that are developing in East Asia and this new area of instability, so that's going to be well worth a peek if you get a chance. Next, to Richard's right is Ewan McGregor. Some of you will be familiar with Ewan's... Did I say Richard? Ewan Graham, sorry. Ewan's work with us over the last few years. He's been our Senior Fellow in International Security for several years. He's got a perfect background for this event as well. He's worked in senior roles at the UK Foreign Office. He served at the British Embassy in Pyongyang. There aren't too many of those around. His most recent analysis for the Laurie Institute actually looked at this question of the North Korea nuclear missile situation and Trump's intervention there. And then finally, Gordon. It's great to have you here, Gordon, from the Perth US Asia Center. Professor Gordon Flake is one of the world's leading experts on North Korea. He's been a senior researcher at the Atlantic Council in the USA working on conflict resolution. He's worked on North Korea for probably more than 30 years, not betraying your age, of course. He's published several books on the topic, and he's been a co-vice chair of the US Committee on Human Rights in North Korea, so eminently qualified to talk about what on earth is going on. What has been going on? It seems there have been three big developments in the last year. There has been the summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. That seems to have been a preoccupation of the United States dealing with that issue. There has been a discussion more recently in the last 6 months about a free and open Indo-Pacific. This has come up with the new US defence national security strategy at the end of last year. What does this exactly mean? And is it a change? And then finally, we have a big and concerning development between the United States and China and a potential trade war. So to talk about this, I think I'd like to start firstly with this issue of the free and open Indo-Pacific. And I don't know if you're like me, but what does Indo-Pacific actually mean? How is it defined? Why have we moved from the Asia-Pacific to the Indo-Pacific before we talk about what is a free and open Indo-Pacific? And so I was going to ask you, Gordon, what does it mean and is it important? And is it unlike Alan Gingell pointed out in a speech for the Australian Institute of International Affairs recently, he said there's no such thing as the Indo-Pacific, it's just convenient terminology.
Well, I think all constructs are convenient terminology for the time and for the strategy. First off, I'm delighted to be here. I appreciate Laurie convening this event. I'm delighted to kind of bring a Western Australian perspective on this issue. With no disrespect on the import of the Tasman Sea, there is a different perspective that you get in Western Australia looking out over the Indian Ocean. And I think that's kind of reflected in the policy and in kind of history, because Australia truly is kind of a two-ocean kind of nation. And the Indian part of that two-ocean nation is relatively nascent, is rising recently. In all candor, I spent 25 years in Washington, D.C., working in the think tank public policy community there, and I mocked the term Indo-Pacific. I thought it was a silly academic notion that had no utility whatsoever for policymakers. But they say where you stand depends on where you sit. After 5 years in Perth, I am, you know, I have the zeal of a convert. I love the Indo-Pacific. I named my grandson Indo-Pacific. My staff has Indo-Pacific tattoos. And those of you who follow the center in our work know that we really kind of brand everything we do Indo-Pacific. And it's not just entirely self-serving. You know, in some respects, Asia-Pacific puts Australia at the bottom, out of sight, out of mind. Indo-Pacific puts Australia squarely in the middle at the pivot point or the fulcrum point. So there is some element of that. But on a more serious level, Australia has always been at the forefront of thinking about how you perceive the region and then how that influences strategy. So just to put it in context, at the beginning of my professional career 30 years ago, nobody used the term Asia Pacific. We talked about Northeast Asia, and candidly, that's all we cared about. Southeast Asia was there, but it was just a problem area. South Asia was different. And Australia was part of this mystical land called Oceania. It was next to Atlantis, and it just kind of floated out there in the world somewhere. And really, it was a previous generation of Australian political leaders who, in partnership with Northeast Asian economies that recognized the need to integrate the region, pushed for Australian membership in the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Initiative, you know, the ASEAN Regional Forum. So Asia-Pacific evolved over the course of the last 30 years to be a term that everybody accepts, but nobody really knows what it means, right? What are the parameters of Asia-Pacific? For some organizations, that includes the entire eastern seaboard of the Americas and the South Pacific. You know, as for others, it's kind of the core. There's no membership. There's no set defined geographic parameters. Now, the difference is that in the last 5 years, more and more people are recognizing that the dividing line between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean is artificial. Right? If you look at energy flows, and we are keenly aware of those, and other resources flows from the WA perspective, going from the Indian Ocean up to the Straits of Malacca, up into the Pacific, you get a sense for how important that is. During the search for MH370, all those efforts were centered there in Perth because Australia was the only country with the capacity, you know, the will to be able to project into that region. And then more importantly, countries, not only is India in its not just look east, but act east policy projecting to the east, but China has also shown a tremendous capacity to kind of reach in there. So it's not a surprise that countries like Japan or Australia or India or increasingly Indonesia are thinking about an Indo-Pacific, an expanded playing field, so to speak. And again, it's not a surprise that the first time that term was used in an official Australian government document was 2013, when then Stephen Smith, then Minister of Defence Stephen Smith from WA was Minister of Defence. It's not a surprise that it seems like every other sentence in the 2017 foreign policy white paper is Indo-Pacific, Indo-Pacific. And then Foreign Minister Julie Bishop obviously brought with that kind of a WA perspective. But even in the shift in 5 years, when I arrived 5 years ago, there was considerable skepticism around the term in Canberra. I don't sense that whatsoever. And I'll end up here. I know I've rattled on for a long time. I had the honor of attending the Shangri-La Dialogue in June. Indian Prime Minister Modi, you know, referenced Indo-Pacific some 11 times in his speech. You know, it followed 2 days after India and Indonesia, you know, framed their agreement in the Indo-Pacific, and a week after the U.S. Pacific Command in Hawaii changed the name of the Pacific Command to the Indo-Pacific Command. And so there is no question that the Indo-Pacific is a concept, or a construct that's here today. It doesn't have defined membership. And I would start by, or end by, making a clear distinction between the geographic, you know, reality on the ground and a strategy for that. And we'll get into that in a bit later. But the free and open Indo-Pacific is an articulation of a U.S. and Japanese strategy. You know, and India and Australia and other countries have different articulations of a strategy. But the region is what the region is. So,
well, I, for one, am very relieved that we now no longer have to call it the Indian Ocean Asia-Pacific, which I think was the term that Julie Bishop used before 2013 when they were trying to merge these two. And they seemed very attached historically to the idea of Asia-Pacific. Richard, what does China think about this?
Well, let me go beyond China. I mean, it's great that Gordon's come from Perth, but I hate to break it to him. The Indo-Pacific term hasn't taken off quite in the rest of the region like it has in Perth and WA. And as he sort of mentioned too at the end, you have to distinguish, and it's kind of a nerdy point, between the Indo-Pacific, the geographic construct, and the Indo-Pacific, sorry, a free and open Indo-Pacific, which is a geopolitical or geostrategic construct, which Japan came up with, actually, and I think the US adopted the Japanese wording. But if you go to the ASEAN countries, I mean, they still prefer Asia-Pacific by and large. Indonesia is a bit of an exception, being an archipelagic state. You know, it spans, like Australia, both oceans. But the sort of strength of the attachment of the Indonesians to the phrase seems to come and go a little bit, maybe depending on personalities. Certainly the other ASEAN countries, you find some interest in it, but no conviction about it. The Singaporeans, in what might be a sort of typical Singaporean fashion, Lee Hsien Loong, the Prime Minister, said whether we end up using the Indo-Pacific, that term might be a sort of Darwinian process. So he would like the sort of big boys and girls to fight it out before he signs on to it. Other ASEAN countries don't like it so much because they think it takes away from this concept of ASEAN centrality. In other words, they want the regional order to revolve around them. And so if we do end up defining Asia-Pacific, and as Gordon says, it's not easily defined, I think the best definition, there's two competing definitions in a way. There's ASEAN plus three, ASEAN plus South Korea, Japan and China, or as we would prefer, ASEAN plus six, including New Zealand, Australia and the United States. And that, I think, is the core of it. But of course, it's been all over the place with APEC and everything else along the way. I think as far as the Indo-Pacific goes at the moment, the US has signed on to the term, Australia has, Japan has, I guess we would say India has as well. China certainly hasn't. At one recent regional meeting, actually it might have been the National People's Congress earlier this year, the Chinese foreign minister sort of mocked that concept along with the idea of the Quad. And he said he hoped it would disappear like foam off a wave. So that tells you a degree of Chinese hostility to it. Not that the Chinese should dictate any of this, but they certainly might have an influence with ASEAN in how this new emerging new regional order is framed.
Moving on to, you know, the meat of this discussion, which is about the things that the US has been doing in what we have now defined as the Indo-Pacific. Firstly, there seems to have been this preoccupation, Ewan, certainly a US preoccupation, or is it the preoccupation of its president with the threat posed by North Korea? And then we had the summit, which you wrote about in your paper. What's happened since then? What have been the ramifications, the reactions around the region? What's developed since then?
Sure. Well, I was in Singapore not so long ago, so maybe I can relay some of those impressions that I picked up there, both about the Trump-Kim summit and around the broader Indo-Pacific concept. But maybe I can just start on the Indo-Pacific and then come in again in more detail to North Korea. Just to add some different perspectives to what Gordon and Richard already have. I used to be a maritime expert, and I think there's a predisposition for people who have a maritime lens on security and connectivity to be attracted to the Indo-Pacific, for the obvious reason that it's an oceanic, transoceanic concept. I think part of the reticence on the part of Asian countries is the fact that Asia has dropped out. So you have the Indo and the Pacific. It's obviously there by very logical inference. You can't have an Indo-Pacific without Asia. But the fact that it's not there in bold capitals, I think, has made some people have second thoughts. If you were to boil down what the Indo-Pacific really means from a strategic point of view, and not simply as a kind of geographical framing device, I think it's to bring India into a more central active role in the Eastern Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific. So there is a sort of balancing element to it from that point of view. One other point I think to make is that although we talk about the Indo-Pacific, there are different definitions, not all of which straddle the full of the length of the Indian Ocean. The formal definition for both Australia and I think the United States too is actually to adopt the dotted line between India and Pakistan, which is interesting because that overlays neatly on the Indo-PACOM area of responsibility. There's no change in that. It always has gone up to that dotted line, bringing in Diego Garcia with the 7th Fleet still have a base. So there's an artificiality about that. Some Indian observers would like the whole of the Indian Ocean to be included. So again, where you sit depends on where you stand. From an Indian perspective, they also have big equities in the security of East Africa and the Gulf, and that they would like those naturally to be brought in. Whereas Australia, it's not just simply good for the national ego to be at the centre of the map rather than an appendage at the lower right, as Australia has been for most of post-European settlement. But I think it makes obvious sense that it is a natural dual ocean framing concept. I agree entirely with what Gordon said. It makes sense for Australia to also be pulling on that rope to try and bring India in. And that also explains, I think, the reticence that that Richard has touched on in China's case, that they see within that maybe the sort of the shadows of a constrainment or containment pattern. But it's also worth pointing out, Richard, that China behaves like an Indo-Pacific power, perhaps more like an Indo-Pacific power than many of those who've actually formally signed up. When you look at the pattern of economic connectivity, its energy supplies, and the string of dual-use naval and trading facilities that it has now across the Indian Ocean. So that's point one on the Indo-Pacific. Briefly, to drill down to the summit between Trump and Kim, I think there was also a lot of concern in the region that the United States was becoming a sort of single issue approach framed around the North Korea passing over the, and also not just the theatrics, but the real problem that would have distracted any US president, regardless of their party stripe or personality, which is to have a regional rogue power passing over the threshold of an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile capability that could directly threaten the US homeland. Only Russia and only China can do that so far, not counting France and Britain, because they're not going to be flying missiles towards the United States anytime soon, however bad the relationship gets. But that was that obviously was a real concern, but it's also one I think plays to a kind of an America first outlook of threat, in that it's one that obviously it's framed on the threat to the homeland rather than the defense of abstract principles and the broader system. I think the Indo-Pacific is very much a kind of a defense of the broader abstract and principles. It's not just a region, it's a region in which half the world's population is located. It's the world's economic center of gravity. The United States is obviously going to have key interests there. But that's not always an easy sell to the American public or the American body politic, where there is a great deal of understandable fatigue at having sort of carried that burden for as long as has been the case. North Korea has sort of loomed very large in that. I think there's probably some relief that it's no longer quite as center stage as it was, and that's allowed the bureaucracy that has already invested in a national security strategy and a national defense strategy, which are very much more broadly framed in Indo-Pacific terms, to develop that broader strategy of a free and open Indo-Pacific. But the dissonance between what the president wants and what his officials want is becoming wider. And that, unfortunately, in my view, is part of the unfortunate collateral of the way that the summit was done. In that it was a kind of upfront gratification, if you like, of granting the reward of a one-on-one meeting with a US president that no North Korean leader had in the past for the price of what was a totally non-binding, non-specific set of general principles. And now we are beginning to see that is North Korea is very good at wedge driving. We often talk about North Korea being able to drive wedges between its allies. The Japan and the United States are okay in the United States. Now we're actually seeing North Korea is beginning to drive wedges within the US administration between Trump's officials and the president. So it's worrying, but at least we have moved on the low threshold or the low bar of success away from the precipice of imminent conflict.
Gordon, have we? Do you agree with me back from that precipice?
We are. I had the honor of, in early this year, writing a Australian foreign affairs piece with Kim Beazley, which was, typically delicately entitled Prepare for War or something like that. And I was really concerned about the risk of a conflict. If you recall, it was only 9 months ago when we were talking about fire and fury that the world has never known. And I agree with the core conclusion that Ewan has just said, which is that we're in a better position. We're back from the precipice. I'm not overly inclined to give an arson a badge for putting out a fire he started, right? And more importantly, if I could take just a step back and look at this specifically from an Australian national interest perspective. Now, I've spent 25 years working the issue in Washington, D.C., and only in the last 5 years have I kind of thought about this as looking at it, from the south up in that regard. And to understand it, really, you have to understand Australia's national strategy for guaranteeing its own national security. In addition to our own extremely capable armed forces, Australia's national strategy has always had, at least in my mind, two primary components. Number one, reliance upon a strong alliance relationship with the United States, and before that, UK. And then the second thing is reliance upon the rules-based global order. Now, we don't talk about that as much, and most people think rules-based global order, which is a mantra in Australian foreign policy, focuses primarily on economic issues and trade, but there's a heavy security component to that as well. And the reason that's important is to understand Australia's role in Korea. For years, the North Koreans have, and as what Ewan rightfully describes as wedge-driving tactics, had tried to make it seem like Australia has no business on the Korean Peninsula. Right? We're just running dogs for the Americans. Why are we following the American things? And so whenever the foreign minister or the defense minister says something, you'll get some rather harsh rhetoric out of North Korea on that front. But the exact opposite is true. If you think about it for a second, Australia is more advanced than North Korea by almost any measure, economically, scientifically, technologically, diplomatically, etc. And yet, Australia as a nation made a conscious decision not to develop nuclear weapons, not to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles, and instead to rely upon the rules-based order, the nuclear non-proliferation regime, the missile control regimes, etc. And so everything that North Korea has been doing for the last several decades that fundamentally undermine that regime, directly undermine Australia's national security. Australia has a direct interest in what's happening in North Korea. Whether it's breaking, six different sets of UN Security Council sanctions resolutions, whether it is violation of the missile technology control regimes or the NPT, all of these things undermine our approach to kind of a rules-based order approach to security. And so Australia rightfully should have a voice in this front. And the problem is now we're in a situation where the Trump administration's approach to this issue, having worked on this for so long, struggled, as most people did, with the summit and all the pageantry around with it. And yet, I strived really hard to keep an open mind, recognizing that I might be, the definition of in the box. I've been working this too long. So maybe it takes a degree of stunning ignorance to be willing to try something. So, hey, it might come out. But when you looked at the Singapore Declaration, all 4 points were issues which had been agreed to previously with greater levels of specificity and rigor, all of which moved directly in the North Korean direction. And that was before the president came out an hour later in a press conference and termed, defensive exercises with allies like South Korea as being provocative and made suggestions that they were too costly and he wanted to pull U.S. troops out of the Korean Peninsula. So from an alliance perspective, and Australia is an ally of the United States, it was a disastrous summit. There's no other way to put it around it. And more importantly, that those agreements, which I agree with Ewan on, didn't accomplish anything. In fact, weakened the international position on all of those, again, directly undermine Australia's national interests. And so obviously, we have hope. We're glad that we're not on the precipice of war we were before. But if I'm looking at this from an Australian national security planner perspective, I'm deeply concerned, not just by what happened in Singapore, but what happened leading up to it, and the complete lack of coordination with allies in the region. Also including close in and directly involved allies like South Korea and Japan. So yeah, it's not a rosy situation.
So disastrous for Australia and its allies, but possibly good for China, Richard.
Well, up to a point. You always have to remember that China and North Korea don't really get on. People tend to have this old view that they're sort of fraternal communist comrades and the like, but they've had very tense relations for a long time, particularly under Kim Jong-un and the like. Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping didn't meet, I think, for about 3-4 years or so. China has played itself back into the game now and put, I think, itself at the center of the diplomatic discussions. It is still, or maybe not now, being worried about the US DPRK discussions. On the one hand, they've encouraged them. On the other hand, they don't want the two countries to get too close. Because, you know, the DPRK, for example, would like, in some respects, doesn't mind having the US around as a hedge against China. Because the DPRK is trying to avoid being dominated by any of the powers around it. So I think China is happy that the rhetoric, we've stepped back from the brink. There are discussions going on. China would be very hopeful about economic reform in North Korea. That's something they've encouraged for a long time. And they think that would be, you know, a precondition for getting genuine security on the Korean Peninsula and getting South Korea and North Korea actually being able to come together, I think. So China is happier than it was, but still, I think, a little on edge.
I want to, because we would like to go to question and answer, and I'm sure you'll have loads of questions, but I do want to move on to the trade and investment aspect of this three-pronged strategy that, or lack of, that's going on in the Indo-Pacific. And there is the announcement just a few weeks ago of this idea of an infrastructure partnership between the United States, Japan, and India, and it appears that it's some sort of counter to the Belt and Road initiative. Now, it appears also that the United States has put about $113 million into this. That's just a million to counter what, on any estimate, is at least a trillion, if not many more trillions than that, by China. What's going on here, Gordon? Is this sort of part of this emphasis on a free and open Indo-Pacific, or is it a trade move? Is it an investment move? Who's supposed to be doing all this activity? How could it possibly match Belt and Road? What's happening?
Well, Richard will be much more of an expert on this, particularly in the China front. I would note that I agree with Ewan's earlier characterization that the Belt and Road Initiative, is, in some respects, is Indo-Pacific with Chinese characteristics, right? The same basic drive, the same basic trend lines, that shifting economic center of gravity in the region is something they recognize is designed to take advantage of it. And I'm also a person who thinks that the Belt and Road Initiative is not something inherently bad, but it is certainly something that merits monitoring, and it merits competition, right? Competing the game in terms of the standards, the norms, how these things are carried out. If I understand correctly, though, that trilateral agreement, which is yet to be fleshed out, is between Japan, Australia, and the United States. I don't believe India has kind of chipped in yet.
Yeah.
The U.S. announcement was actually independent of that even still, and it was a kind of a seed money of $113 million, which you're right. It pales in comparison with the estimates of some $40 billion put in there by China. I would highlight, however, that if you look at just within ASEAN itself, you know, Japan every year, I mean, has an investment stock, I believe, in infrastructure of around $200 billion, right? So far more than the kind of the announced $40 billion of projects under the Belt Road Initiative. It just doesn't get the same level of attention because Japanese investment tends to come in terms of corporate investment. As a result, it tends to be market-based and they tend to work, right? You know, whereas the BRI has got an awful lot of statecraft behind it, because there's an awful lot of, you know, pitch and propaganda in that process. But I think, you know, that, again, there's such a crying need for infrastructure in this region, whether it is the traditional means of the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank or new organizations, which, thanks to Australian influence, like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, are actually functioning, you know, quite respectably, right? Or, you know, BRI or the Japanese existing infrastructure fund, or this new collaboration, they're all welcome, right? They just need to be, you know, open and competed well in transparency.
Richard, Belt and Road.
Well, Belt and Road is going through sort of convulsions at the moment on two levels. Inside China, when we forget about inside China, the Chinese technocratic elite are quite happy for some of the criticism from overseas in some respects because they want to push back against the current Belt and Road as well. They're worried about China wasting billions and billions of dollars and, in fact, causing political problems for themselves along the way. They lost a lot of money in Venezuela. They lost a lot of money in Angola. They've got an seriously embarrassing situation in Sri Lanka where they took over the port when the Sri Lankans couldn't pay for it anymore. In other words, Exhibit A for the evil Westerners' criticism of China of pursuing debt trap diplomacy. So you can see, and you can see from how Xi Jinping spoke about Belt and Road this week, you know, Belt and Road's not going anywhere, right? It's written into the party constitution, so they can't dump it. But they are recalibrating it now to make sure it's on commercial terms and it's handled much better politically within each country itself. Look at Malaysia, for example. Dr. Mahathir hasn't quite dumped the Belt and Road projects. The biggest Belt and Road project, the biggest single one, I think, is the East Malaysia Railway. But it's all but been put on the back burner. So China has a real facing real headwinds on this issue. And on the issue of Japan, actually, Japan is the only real competitor to China. And to Japan's great credit, they have tried to compete with China and sort of followed them around in many ways on many of the infrastructure plays to offer on commercial terms their services as well. And of course, China, Japan has particularly ramped up its efforts in India, which is really
project.
Yeah, well, it's kind of bypassed in the Belt and Road largely. The Chinese are trying to get the Indians on board at the moment, but because of the involvement in Pakistan, you know, that's the one country where it's very hard to know how exactly how much money has been spent on the Belt and Road, but Pakistan is one place where they have spent a lot of money, and that's the Chinese. People forget, I think Chinese are real risk takers, and they appear to have decided that they can only sort of stabilize Pakistan with the China model, building it up economically. And it's proving to be very, very difficult. And in some respects, that's why India is a much clearer field for the Japanese.
And what about the United States, though? Is it just kidding itself that it can actually enmesh itself in the region with infrastructure, investment? Given China's, you know, much deeper economic ties with our Asia Power Index, which we released earlier this year,
the extent
of the difference between the two players in the region was quite massive.
US can't be China in Asia. They simply haven't got the resources. And I mean, they do, but not in the way that China does. And just to give you an example of how the Chinese institutions that are involved here, Gordon mentioned the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, a great Chinese soft power victory. Which is actually a very good organisation, but they go through their loan applications very carefully, and they've lent about $5 billion. So they're kind of a victim of their own success. The Exim Bank and the China Development Bank, the big Chinese state lenders for overseas projects, they've lent hundreds of billions of dollars. And so the US cannot gear up. You know, Congress barely pays the World Bank bill. You know, they're not going to sort of put $100 billion offshore in Asia when the US itself is having its own debate about infrastructure. So, you know, it's got to be worked through other ways, I think.
And then we have this looming trade war. So that's a final point before we go to the audience for questions. Is this a real prospect? Is this going to tip the balance in the United States' favour or in China's favour?
I don't know how that will work out. We are moving from trade conflict to a trade war, I think. The idea that it would be settled quickly before the midterm elections in the US so Trump could sort of parade that in his campaign, I think that's off the board now. We're about to get the next big round of tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports into the US. And we're waiting to see exactly what the Chinese retaliation, and there will be, on that, and then we'll be able to get a sense of how it's going to play out. But I think it's totally unpredictable.
And Ewan, just a final word from you. Does all of this activity, which is a bit contradictory and conflicting, does it just bear a sort of any cohesive strategy from the United States in the region? How do you see that?
Well, I think the economic component is key to selling it to the region, because there is a long-standing concern in the region that when the United States has a regional strategy, it takes an over-militarized form. And that has been augmented, particularly since the rejection of the Trans-Pacific Partnership by the Trump administration. So at least it's a start. It means that it's got an economic leg. That economic leg is not going to be the same as China. You're not going to compete with China on quantity. What you can compete on is quality. And that's really where I think the emphasis for the Indo-Pacific free and open strategy has to be. That you're not necessarily selling capital in quantitative terms, and there isn't really a shortage of capital, despite the infrastructure needs in the region. Often there's a shortage of things like skilled project management, the ability to deliver quality on time, the ability to manage projects cleanly without corruption both internally and of the the provider as well. Let's make no bones about it. I think the more that Japan, Australia, and the United States can create a narrative, they at least frame a choice in the minds of the region that there's not only one provider, because many wouldn't want to go to China if they felt they had a choice. And there is a narrative, an important narrative element to this, and that needs to be quality versus quantity if you want to reduce it down to a simple slogan.
Can I just add a little bit of a capstone on that, in that the notion of a free and open Indo-Pacific as a specific strategy, again, is one long espoused by Japan. In November of last year, when President Trump visited Vietnam and the Philippines, he used the Japanese terminology and couched it almost in a let's compete with China kind of way, which made the region quite uncomfortable. You know, Australia has not used the same terminology. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we have exact set formulation, but obviously rules-based order tends to creep into descriptions of it. And one of the things that made Prime Minister Modi's speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue this past June so notable was the fact that he talked about a free, open, rules-based order, inclusive, ASEAN Central Indo-Pacific. So basically it made it a lot less threatening, a lot more open. We love everybody. You're all in there. And again, why it's important to make the distinction between geographic trends, economic integration trends, incorporation of India, the region as we think about it, and specific strategies for it. Because as indicated earlier, the Japanese strategy is to kind of the full sweep of the two oceans all the way to Africa. The Indians are much more interested in Africa. We sitting in our little perch in Perth are much more interested at the heart of the Indo-Pacific, really, India through Japan in that context. But that's okay, because the same thing is true about the Asia-Pacific as it goes forward. When it comes down to this core question of economic instability, I'm not so sure I would view the U.S. efforts in the last month to reestablish some alternative to the TPP as an economic leg. It's kind of a vestigial tail that's kind of left over there. There's not much there yet, right? And that's a real problem. It's a real problem that we don't yet have kind of an economic strategy. And on top of that, there's so much instability in the other legs of the policy that I think there's great anxiety in the region. And ironically, and this is the last point I'll make, is that while for a decade plus, states in the region have been concerned about the rise of China and they've been forging ties and relationships a la Japan, India, Australia in India and in Japan, etc., those efforts have been hypercharged in the last 18 months out of anxiety about what the United States does. You know, so I think what you've seen in the last 6 months alone is everybody in the region. I mean, you've now got the Brits and the French back in the region saying, we're Indo-Pacific powers, right? You know, because everybody needs partners in an era of uncertainty.
So this is the cue for some questions. Could we have a wait for a microphone and just identify yourself?
Thank you. Very interesting set of topics, but I'd just like to make two quick comments. One is that Richard said that there were signs that China was recalibrating its activities in relation to the Belt and Road to make them more acceptable. And I think that could only be expected, really, because they haven't been doing it very long. They've encountered various problems of being too heavy-handed and so on and so on. And you'd expect that they would learn from these experiences and do it better. So that's one comment. The second comment is, I really think that some of the rhetoric and comments that are around about the trade war are very worrying. For instance, the other day, and these are just comments reported in our press, but one comment was by a senior Chinese official saying that one-third of the US's demands on China, which it was trying to enforce through the tariffs, involved changing China's long-term economic and technological aspirations, and it would not give way on any of those. A day or two later, another senior Chinese official apparently was speaking about the row with America, and he said, America is trying to crush us with its use of tariffs. Now, that's a very basic sort of comment to make. It's really like a war, isn't it? And if one side of this dispute really thinks that America using its economic power is out to crush it. I don't know how you get a good outcome out of that.
Mm. Well, I think on some estimates, that at the most sort of aggressive level, we're talking about, you know, possibly at its worst taking about 1% off China's GDP growth. And that would exacerbate the sort of domestic economic pressures that are evident in China at the moment. Did you have any comment on that question?
Yeah, I know the comment you're talking about. That was made by Liu He, who's the number one economic advisor to Xi Jinping, and was the negotiator. Of course, he went over to Washington and they sort of all blew up in his face, so he won't go back. So what he said was 30 to 40% of what the US is asking for, we can do straight away. 20 to 30% is negotiable. The final 20 to 30%, which you mentioned, is off the table, and that is basically about state investment in technology. China 2025, China investing in its own homegrown technology to catch up with the West and Japan and South Korea. I certainly think, this is happening on both sides of the Pacific. I think, and Gordon might have a view on this, that the US has changed its view on China. The engagement school, put very broadly, is really in the minority these days, and that's reflected back in China. People in the US might see China's already been for years pursuing this strategy. They've just been called out about it now. But now they think that the US does want to stop their rise. I was in Beijing a couple of weeks ago. One official said to me, "We now realize that, you know, we have to fight the US in every theater arena short of direct military conflict." And so the US policy has the maybe unintended effect of playing into the deepest, darkest paranoia of the Chinese, which is not to say what the US analysis is wrong, and I'm not sure how you take on the Chinese in a nice way. But what you say is right. They're sort of decoupling. The economic relationship was once ballast. It's now becoming the battleground.
Well, just to respond specifically to that point, in the 25 years I worked on these issues in Washington, D.C., the role of the business community was always key in the early most favored nation debates on China's accession to WTO, et cetera. And probably the most significant development in the last 5 years is China has lost the business community. So you do not have in the American business community the same level of kind of full-throated advocacy for the relationship that we've had in a long time. And that's really important politically. And it's different than Australia, obviously, given the exports of resources and the relative dependency on that particular front. But having said that, you know, there has been some real serious issues in terms of the way China organizes economic activities in the region, in its own standards and norms, and some fundamentally unfair trading practices that everybody agrees with. Australians agreed with it, Japanese, Koreans, everybody else agrees with it, and that should have been addressed, right? Unfortunately, it's not that the Trump administration has misdiagnosed the problem. It's just that it's so inept about how they go about it. You know, the notion that, you know, trade wars are good and easy to win are crazy, right? And yet now we're focusing on straining things like soybeans and ignoring some of the core systemic and structural things that need to be changed. And you've had this revolving door of officials doing this. So it really makes me concerned. And let me make one final point about what I see in my mind as kind of one of the fundamental questions about where China is going. Having spent so much time in Washington, I brought to WA with me an inherent skepticism about China, right? Where I was more concerned about Chinese weakness than Chinese strength. And that, I think, is probably the consensus in Washington. You spend enough time there to know, right? So people who are worried about systemic problems, issues, demographics, environment, et cetera. And so I'm not worried about China having another 30 years of unbroken growth and become the dragon eats the world. I'm worried about what happens if they don't, right? Because that's a far more cataclysmic event. So if that's my basic view, I'm watching what's happened over the last 3 years with Xi Jinping and his concentration of power. And I'm a bit torn because on the one hand, it's evidence that the Chinese system is doing what China's system has done well for decades now, which is not ignoring problems, right? They're preparing for 18 months from now when the largest segment in China's working population is ages 50 to 70. not exactly an recipe for vibrant growth, right? The demographic change, the environmental change, the regional pushback. And they know they've got some real tough days ahead, so they're bunkering down, they're strengthening policies, etc. The only problem with that is, and this is where I'm torn, is that there's no evidence to suggest that retreating to an old school, single decision maker, bad information flow, truth-free kind of decision-making environment is good. And that's where the overlies with this fundamental question. Because, all right, you look at Belt Road Initiative, I hope they learn from it, and I know the individual corporations will do, but the whole Belt Road Initiative itself, when it was launched, all my friends in China laughed at it. They thought it was a joke, right? They thought they could mock it just like they mocked Hu Jintao's silly initiatives and Jiang Zemin's silly initiatives. And then quickly they realized that Xi is a different kettle of fish and they had to pay attention to it. And now the problem is everybody's throwing everything they can in the Belt Road Initiative, and the decisions are not being made market-based. They're based on what you need to do to be promoted politically in a system that rewards you. And I don't see that decision-making process getting better. I see that decision-making process under the concentration power getting worse. So that's kind of the tension that overlays those two issues for me.
Charlie Lyons-Jones.
South Korea's got its new northern policy. Taiwan's got its new southbound policy. China's got the Belt and Road Initiative. Japan's got the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. And the United States has its own version of that strategy. Is there any prospect of the United States harmonizing the policies of Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan so as to dilute China's influence?
I'll start, then others can chime in. I don't think so until the U.S. gets its own strategy. I mean, so again, I welcome the use of the term Indo-Pacific. I think it's a good thing. To be honest, I think the way the U.S. couched it last year was harmful. So for 2 years in a row, thanks to the largesse of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, I've gone up to Korea essentially as an evangelist for the Indo-Pacific, because Koreans are deeply skeptical of the idea, right? They view it as a U.S.-Japanese cabal against China, and they don't want any part of that, right? And they don't view it in the context of a broader shifting economic center of gravity from Northeast Asia to Southeast Asia and those trends. And so I'm kind of pitched them in that concept. But when the U.S. is not part of TPP, when the U.S. doesn't have a clear regional economic strategy, it's really difficult for me to see the U.S. play a role. And more importantly, at least as long as the Trump administration is in, the Trump administration despises anything multilateral. And this is something we don't discuss enough here in Australia. I mean, you're hard-pressed to find any country in the world that is a more full-throated defender of multilateralism than Australia. It goes back to the rules-based order that I was talking about earlier. That's the core of it, right? Whereas this Trump administration, give me one example where they've done anything to support anything multilateral, anything that's systems-wide, right? They want it broken down, you know, and again, here I'm being perhaps overly critical, but I think accurately so. The U.S. on trade and in terms of regional integration is doing the same thing that we rightfully accuse China of doing in the South China Seas, which is refusing or blocking or eschewing or avoiding multilateral efforts, you know, a ASEAN code of conduct, you know, as a group, and instead preferring to have might makes right, the strong do what they will, the weak must suffer what they must, kind of bilateral relationship with the Philippines and Vietnam. How's that different from the U.S. pulling out of the TPP and right now continuing to bash Japan, you know, to have a bilateral free trade agreement, which Japan does not want, you know, and to extract economic costs from Japan for the refusal to engage in bilateral, where they want might makes right. So again, and we saw it this week with NAFTA as well. So therein lies a fundamental problem that won't be solved until that is changed.
Speaking of multilateral organizations, you and you've just come back from Singapore. And I noticed there was a potential move for China and ASEAN nations to be joining in military exercises close to China. Is this an attempt by China to sort of draw the ASEANs in? And how have they responded to this sort of geopolitical containment battle between the US and China?
So this is the thing, right, with ASEAN's centrality. ASEAN wants to be central. If you have a framing concept, the Indo-Pacific is the one that puts it right bang in the middle. But ASEAN isn't particularly happy with that because it also has a sort of proprietorial attitude towards wanting to be at the center of the, to be the facilitator for all dialogue and architecture, to use the term for dialogue around it. I think that's the problem, is this, if we talk about, will the centre hold? The centre is a weak centre if ASEAN is the one that has to bear the geopolitical brunt of the competition that defines the Indo-Pacific. We haven't talked about the Quad, and that tells its own story. And this goes back to Charlie Lyons-Jones's question. You talked about Taiwan, you talked about South Korea. If the Indo-Pacific is a framing device, if it has an operating system, it should be something rather like the Quad with an ASEAN component. For the obvious reason, look at the compass points. Japan in the north, Australia in the south, India in the west, United States in the east. And yet the Quad has almost gone without a whimper. We've had two meetings since it was officially resuscitated, both at senior officials level, and the key question about whether the Quad would be able to buy in at the least contentious area of infrastructure development has been answered, because the weakest link on that was India, frankly, because India did not want to sign up to that economic component. So we ended up with, by default, a kind of trilateral US, Australia, Japan. And that, to me, is the weakness of the Indo-Pacific, because to go back to my original point, if it's to have real geopolitical import, it's bringing India in to the Eastern Indian Ocean and the Western Pacific. India's reluctant to do that, and for the moment, it's not showing no signs of wanting to play along. So I think the weakness of the Quad itself tells its own story. But for the moment, the Indo-Pacific is not really taking off. Frankly, I don't think it will until you have a unity of threat perceptions. Okay, I'm at core a realist on this. I think you don't have that unity of threat perceptions, and it will probably take a crisis to force one. That's a dangerous thing to wish for. But I think that until you actually do get something that really frames it in very hardcore crisis-like terms, you won't get that gelling amongst the allies and partners.
Just two things. First, a comment on what Gordon said, and secondly, a question. The comment is that further proof of the importance in American policy at the moment, which is Trump's policy on bilateralism, in the news today, Trump said about NAFTA, that he didn't like NAFTA at all. He's having a bilateral treaty with Mexico and just getting rid of NAFTA, and what does that do to Canada? So it emphasizes it. And my question is, in terms of the dominance of Trump in I don't know whether the correct word is policy, that in the news today, and I don't know whether it's fake or not, is that America has decided to reintroduce military exercises on the Korean Peninsula because Trump is not pleased with what Kim is doing. So what might that do to all issues about working together and so on in the Indo-Pacific?
Gordon,
I think. Well, I mean, I'm strongly supportive of military exercises. And again, as a nation state, you have an obligation to defend your country, but you also have an obligation to defend your troops or defend your country, right? And so to place 26,000, 24,000 U.S. troops in the Korean Peninsula, but not to give them necessary practice and exercises and experience and planning required to do their job is criminal, right? So the notion that the United States should have ceased those exercises, which are in violation of no laws, standards, or norms, I find there's a real false equivalency between North Korea's actions, you know, violating U.N. Security Council sanctions, resolutions, international laws and norms, you know, and a normal military exercise were defensive. Again, they could be provocative when seen from North Korean's perspective, but I think it's immoral not to do them. So I think that's a welcome development. I think their cessation was a mistake. I don't know that that's going to be a tipping point, because to be honest, we were assured before the summit that the North Koreans were completely fine with it. That's what the North Koreans told South Korea. This is actually more a reflection of Trump psychosis than it is actually any developments on the peninsula or the region itself. Yeah. Yeah, so obviously this is a further deterioration of a deal which did not exist, right? And therein lies the problem, right? So, I mean, progress is good, crisis avoidance is good, but the underlying concern I have with where we are in the Korean Peninsula is that the diplomatic option has been squandered so poorly, right? Because now, think about it, if we return to an escalatory trajectory like we were in late January, when the debate was whether or not the U.S. had a bloody nose strategy or if it was really a decapitation strategy, right? Where they were openly seeking to goad North Korea into action to respond to that, right? If we return to that, there's no diplomatic valve anymore, right? We've done a summit. We've given them everything, right? And it becomes a lot more complicated. I think the sole saving grace is there's so many other problems in the world that are going to be distracting at this point. We'll just see. It's a race in time to how it plays out. But.
Summit 2.0, yeah?
I think it's the U.S. position on the Korean Peninsula. Certainly the Trump administration hasn't made its situation any easier for itself. But let's take a step back. This isn't all around sort of dystopia around Trump. I think there are broader structural factors that make much more difficult choices for the United States. And I think the thing that really captures it for me is a sense that those who are in the Korean Peninsula, including the head of the U.S. Forces career, there's a tendency to want to sort of reach for the status quo because that's really the only thing that preserves the United States position as it is. If the United States were to move back, as Gordon says, towards a more assertive, aggressive policy in which conflict enters the frame once again, the United States is going to expend its remaining energy. The alliances might break as a result. It's not going to end up ahead of that. China will probably move into the void. And if it moves the other way around towards a kind of appeasement approach towards North Korea, the South Koreans embracing engagement, the credibility of the United States alliance system also fractures and suffers as a result. You move forward, you end up in a bad result. You move back, you end up in a bad result. So there's a tendency to want to cling to the status quo. The problem is I just don't think the status quo is tenable. And it's framed in a much broader context. It's not just North Korea and Trump. It's also about the relative power shifts and balances in which China is a clearly central factor.
I just say on NAFTA, I think actually what happened today is good news. You know, Trump threatening to blow up NAFTA, he's done it once a week before breakfast for 2 years. So there's no big deal on the rhetoric. The fact that the US will Lighthizer, the USTR head, who's quite a hard head, has managed to reach a deal with Mexico, that Trump has endorsed that deal. What Trump was talking about today appeared to be putting pressure on Canada to reach a negotiating deadline on Friday. And in any case, you know, you can't just blow up NAFTA, I think, at the whim of the president. There's got to be a congressional vote, et cetera, et cetera. So the fact that the US has done a deal with Mexico, it means they might now get one with Canada. Remember, Trump also has made his peace temporarily, at least at the moment, with Europe. So I would say all of that is bad for China because it leaves all these trends at the moment just putting the US against China, but perhaps the US with its other big trading partners alongside of it.
We've just reached 1:45, so thank you very much. So our hour is up. I want to thank Richard Ewan, I'll get their names right this time, and especially Gordon for coming all of the way from Western Australia to talk to us today. Breakfast has certainly got interesting, fake news and fake Google even this morning. I'm very glad to have had that definition of the Indo-Pacific and find out that Australia is finally at the centre of something. Thank you very much to you all for coming and for your excellent questions. We hope to see you again soon.